Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner podcast. November 15th, episode 68. Oh, what a night. Hi, everyone. Welcome to a little place we like to call the Beekeeper's Corner. We're recording this on a Saturday night, and tonight, well, you could picture it as a little cozy corner conversation with a nice steaming cup of tea and honey and a chat with our friend Mr. Tim Schuler, the New Jersey State Apiarist. Tim, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Kev. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm not getting any audio out of you, Tim. Let me see if we have you muted for some reason.
Can you hear me, Kev?
I do not hear you.
Oh, no.
Okay, we're going to have to put a pause on this and see what's going on. It's funny, we were just talking to you a second ago.
I know. Well, I don't know what the heck happened.
We got you now. Okay. So, Tim, you're a little under the weather. You got a little bit of a cold, but you agreed to come in here and participate with us, and we really appreciate you joining us once again.
Hey, Kevin, in my world, if you don't push to get stuff done, you're never going to get nothing done. So, hey, as long as my voice holds out and I don't start hacking too bad, let's press on.
Good to go. And for everybody that's listening to this, you should know we did this as a video podcast that will be available out on the YouTube channel. So if you prefer to watch it, you can go to youtube.com/NWNJBA. It'll be one of the latest videos out there. Tonight we're going to meander around what's been going on around here. Initially, our focus of attention is going to be on the season close down to start. We'll take a turn about raising queens, and then we'll see where things take us. And really, no segments. It's just going to be a roundtable fireside chat this time around. And Tim, as you know, our tradition is to start each episode with a local hive report. So I'll ask you to sit back for a second while we break down what's going on around here. And when I'm done, I think it would be great if you could contribute to what you have going on in your local yard.
Sure.
So right now, all is quiet on the local front. In September, I put an apivar treatment, which you kindly supplied me with, Tim. It's Amitraz. We put it in the one hive that we checked that the threshold was high, had 13 mites in a sample. And I should have monitored this in July and August, but the ability to get into the hives was delayed by, I had a cold one week and was sick and out of commission, and then two trips out of state. One of them was for a wedding. Another one was for a vacation. Well, net, it was September before we can get in and check the mite levels. No July and August time frame. So, anyway, it's supposed to be in there for 6 weeks, and you're supposed to yank it out of there, and we just cranked it out, making sure that we didn't leave it in there. And, Tim, you know, you can't leave that stuff in there. It's against the packaging, and it's really not good karma to leave old treatments in there and let the mites get resistant to it.
That's correct, Kevin. The last thing we need is them to get resistant to apivar.
Yeah, so the other activity in the local front was we bit the bullet and combined that nuke that I had that was not going to overwinter with the top bar. At the recommendation of a reader, I smoked both of those hives, just gassed them. And then I combined them, and they did not have a war. I was really happy about that. And one of the other things I should mention is the top bar hive is an Italian hive, Italian bees, and the nuke was a Carniolian hive. I think that's how you say that. I always get that screwed up. And usually when you combine the races, it doesn't turn out well. And, Tim, I had no problem with that. They melded together. I didn't see a big war, and I think they just accepted their buddies.
Kevin, how did you get the Langstroth frames into a top bar hive?
So what I did was I pulled them off the nuke, and I shook them in the hive real hard, and then I just brushed whatever was left. And I put them off in a side area and then just let them walk in and get to where the colony was kept.
Okay, so you didn't add the combs, you just added the bees.
I didn't, but the combs that are in there were Langstroths to start, and you could watch a video on our YouTube channel of how I used one of those vibration tools to cut the comb on both sides and make it a V-shape so it would load in there.
Okay.
And my hive, what I built, has the capability of using a standard Langstroth frame dimension on the top. So
okay. Very good.
So it's really cold this week, and in the week ahead, we're looking at highs of the 30s and 40s. I expect that all the girls are going to be huddled together, dreaming of warmer days and spring flowers, just like we are. And I have to say, Tim, we've been really cold in the house. We finally lit the wood stove today, and it's very nice and toasty in here, so hence the fireside chat.
Hey, we've been doing the same thing, Kevin. I'm trying not to turn the heat on as long as I can. So we've just been using the wood stove, and it sure does toast things up when you get those baby going on a nice cold day like today.
Yeah, we did a little firewood stacking this afternoon, and the wood is good and dry, thankfully. It's tough when you're working with wet stuff. So, Tim, how about your local hive report? What do you have going on this time of year?
Well, I'm still trying to get the rest of my mouse guards on. I got them all on, but just one yard now. All the rest of them got them on. And when it starts getting this cold, I'm nervous. I don't want mice getting in there and tearing things up. My colonies, I keep on solid bottom boards, but if a beekeeper's using a screen bottom, this is the time you got to get those bottoms closed so that there's not a big draft blowing on the bees. The other thing I just finished this past week was when I move bees in the summer, I just use a flat plywood lid. And I get them off for the winter and use an inner cover and an outer cover as tools to help keep condensation from forming inside the hive. Very important, Kevin, when you use an inner cover and an outer cover, that you put your deep side down in the winter if you have one on the inner and put a shim on top of the inner so it lifts the outer cover up just a hair. That will allow a bee to get out of there if they need to. It'll allow moist air and help to prevent condensation. And the other thing, Kevin, is if you get snow and ice at the entrance, the bees can still breathe and they still have an exit if they need it through that top cover, up through the hole in the inner cover. And that is just so important and gives me such peace of mind. I've had people email me on Christmas Eve wanting to know if they needed to go out and shovel out the front of their hive, because the blizzard and snow was covering the hive. They could see it at 10 o'clock on Christmas Eve. Mind you, they sent this email to my state email address as if I was actually checking it at 10 o'clock on Christmas Eve. But in any case, I've never swept out or shoveled in front of a beehive in 30 years, as long as we give them that upper entrance so that they can get in and get out the top if they need to.
Yeah, and some of the listeners are new beekeepers, and they're probably wondering what, if anything, they have to do when they get 3 feet of snow. And you're correct in that heavy snow situation, and this is the body of the topic we want to talk about. We want to talk about winter prep here, talk about feeding and windbreaks and handling snowstorms and moisture management and things like that. And again, I think there's a lot of first-year beekeepers who are fretting. I don't know if you've heard this. I was listening to ABC News this morning. Amy Fries is the meteorologist in the morning. She was discussing about this freeze that's coming across right now that we're experiencing in New Jersey and northeast United States. They're saying this winter is going to be the equivalent of the worst winter on record, which was 1976 as far as cold and snowfalls. I don't know if you've heard that, but I can imagine people who are new first-year beekeepers are really concerned about how bees are going to overwinter and what they're going to do. So, Tim, you get 3 feet of snow. What do you do with your hives?
I'm telling you, Kevin, if they're prepared correctly and you've made that, put that three-quarter-inch piece block of wood up under the outer cover so it lifts it up a little bit, you won't have to do nothing. Some of the lowest death losses I've ever had over the winter are years when there's a lot of snow and when it gets cold and stays cold. As far as I'm concerned, the worst winter for bees is when it's cold for a week and then it's warm for a week, cold for a week, warm for a week, because they don't maintain that cluster. They tend to eat a lot more feed during those types of winters, and you'll have a greater chance of starvation. In my experience of keeping bees for 30 years, cold is not going to kill bees in New Jersey. But it's failure to control varroa mites at the right time of year. It's lack of food reserves where the colony starves out. Those are by far the worst things for bees.
You have to agree, and I've seen heavy snows, 3 feet of snow, and typically what I find, Tim, is the heat actually penetrates or escapes out of that lower entrance and melts the snow, and in due time, even if it's to the roof of the hive, you'll still see air rising in front of that, and it'll create this cocoon around. And I also find, Tim, that I think the snow creates kind of an insulation and actually helps protect them from wind and cold when it's really deep. And I don't know if it's right to say they're dormant, but when they're cold all the time, they do stay on the cluster and tend to be less wasteful of the stores that they have.
I agree 100%, Kevin. That's why it's very important for the location of your apiary. Those bees need to be in full sun, because even with 3 feet of snow on the ground, on a nice, sunny, still day, where the wind's not blowing, and if, as long as they're in full sun, they will be able to fly out and cleanse themselves when they get a little bit of a break in the cold.
So to that point, let's talk about cleansing flights. If people don't understand what that means, what does it look like to a new beekeeper? They've got white snow all over the ground, and all of a sudden they see all the stuff all over the place. What does a cleansing flight look like as far as an observation thing?
Yeah, the honeybees don't defecate inside the hive, so on a cleansing flight, they will fly out and they will excrete their feces. You'll see little yellowish streaks or blobs possibly in the snow. You may see even a few bees that get into the snow. Those are bees that are weak or maybe near the end of their life, and when they fly out to cleanse, they may end up in the snow and die. So it's not uncommon to see a smattering of dead bees on the ground. Even with the snow, it's painfully obvious when everything's white and covered with snow, as opposed to grass and dirt and stuff like that.
So in the extreme northeast, they have situations where the hives are literally buried, and they're coming with poles, poking through the snow, trying to find the hives to dig them out and let them fly. Talk a little bit about releasing them, and then sometimes they get caught up where they have nosema, and they start to spew on the hive itself. What kind of pattern does that look like?
Well, the nosema that causes the streaking on the hives, the researchers tell us we don't really have that type of nosema anymore. That's called nosema apis. The nosema that is across our country now is nosema serrani, and you generally do not see that diarrhea all over the inside of the hive with nosema serrani. However, there is another condition called dysentery, which when the bees keep their feces in their body too long and are not able to fly out and cleanse, they obviously can't hold it forever, and they get a diarrhea-like condition, and that could be runny streaks of a yellowish-brown substance inside of the hive, around and near the cluster, if the bees were not able to fly. Kevin, I also see this in colonies where, because they did not have their varroa mites controlled, you see the clusters shrink over the course of the winter to the point where they're about the size of a softball, and they do not have the synergy to be able to warm up the inside of that colony to give the bees enough residual warmth to fly out and cleanse. And those instances, I see streaks of diarrhea or dysentery all over the inside of the hive as well.
Isn't there some aspect of this, if you feed your bees really late and they don't get a chance to ripen that nectar or sugar solution, that it's wet and there's a lot of moisture in there that causes this too?
Well, and that can cause dysentery issues as well, Kevin. Too high a moisture in the feed they're eating over the winter. That's why I tell people, ideally, you should be monitoring your colonies in September, and if they are not gaining weight, you should start to feed them sugar syrup. This year I had several beekeepers call me with colonies that starved out in October because the beekeeper assumed that they were bringing in food because there was a lot of blossoms of goldenrod. But I'm telling you, the goldenrod flow stunk this year.
It was terrible.
I didn't smell it anywhere myself, Bob Hughes smelled it in some bee yards. But if a beekeeper didn't realize that till the last week in October and started feeding, now 10 days into trying to fatten their bees for the winter before they die, we get this wicked cold that we've got now. They're not going to take feed off a feeder, and they're not going to be able to process it because they can't fly in this weather.
I knew my hives were light, and I started feeding them sometime in late August, early September, and I fed them through to October and got them heavy, and then I got the feeders off. I put my mouse guards on early, and I put my inserts under my screen bottom boards and got everything buttoned up and made sure that I was set. As you know, we've had discussions about this. I got robbed last year. It just decimated my hive, so I made sure that I got them all buttoned up or whatever. And, you know, the last thing I had to do was get that treatment off, get those feeders off, get everything closed up. And I don't have to worry about windbreaks. And I don't know, this is something that people should be considering if they're on a hill or in an area where there's a prevailing wind. In my case, the wind is coming from behind and there's woods. And actually, across from where my hives are, there's a cornfield. And they haven't cut the corn down yet, which is really, really strange. The deer and whatever is in there eating it all, but it's preventing any wind from blowing through. So what other winter prep things should people be considering this time of year?
Well, let me tell you, Kevin, windbreak is really critical if you're in a, you know, in an open apiary. I like, obviously, apiaries that are strongly protected to the north and the west. So even on a windy day, down where the bees are, there's not much wind, and the sun can get in there and warm things up for them. I have one bee yard that I have a tin wall behind the hives. Only goes up 3 feet. It's still windy where my head is, but if I get down where the bees are, it's nice and toasty on a nice warm day, even in the middle of the winter. So that's a good idea. Some people use round bales, straw bales, snow fence, tin, any type of pallets that would help break the wind off those bees so that they can get warmed up and get out and cleanse themselves regularly. The other thing, Kevin, is so vitally important is to have a weight on your lid. Once you put that shim under there on top of the inner cover, you want to make sure you're either using a ratchet strap, or if you're in the northern part of the state, there's usually plenty of rocks in every apiary. Get some weight on top of those lids, because the last thing you want is you've done everything right, and now you go back after you hadn't been there for a month, the lid's upside down, rain and snow's on the inner cover running down on top of the bees, and that really just, there's no excuse for that, Kev.
Agreed. You know, this is the time of year, too, where there's still some bears, and I don't know if you got a phone call, one of our Northwesters had a bear in their hive this week, just this past week. So wow. You also have to be aware of that. If you have bear fences, you should still be baiting them.
Yep.
They're out there just finishing up. This cold might chase them indoors wherever they're going to hibernate. But up until this week, I think they're still pretty active.
I would agree with you. As I told you, when I just the other day, I popped the last of my flat plywood lids off. And when I looked down, the bees were very lethargic. They'd still stick their tails up in the air at you and drip venom and kind of fan their wings. But they were clustered down between the frames on honey. And I just put my inners on and my outers on quickly and weighted the lids. And those babies are ready to go. I'm very pleased with how some of them look. They got real big clusters, got a lot of weight in the hive. I have a few that are on the light side. But at this stage of the game, Kevin, they're not going to take any more feed. So what they have, they have. I tend to like to mark those that I think are light so that in February, when they start flying a little, I can supplement their feed if I need to. And that way I don't have to reevaluate. I know the ones that were light in the fall, they're the ones I'm going to pay close attention to in the spring.
Hey, what are you? What's your vision there, Tim? Are you going to feed them dry sugar? Are you going to feed them fondant? Are you going to put pollen patties? So where do you think you're kind of, you know, let's talk about opening a hive in the wintertime. People are curious what's going on in there. What recommendations do you have for people who are worried about their hives making it through and they can't resist a peak or do whatever, it gives some guidance in that perspective.
Kevin, I am not against looking inside a hive in the wintertime. I am against pulling out frames, especially when the bees are clustered. You pull apart frames when the bees are clustered, the cluster cannot get itself reestablished before the cold of evening comes. You're going to be killing a lot of bees in your hive.
Yeah.
There's no need to do that. Honeybees will share their food. That's just their nature of them. If a handful of bees can get to food, they will take it, suck it into their bellies, and pass it on to their sisters on the other side of the cluster. Okay? So pop in the inner cover to see where the cluster is. There's nothing wrong with doing that. Obviously, you're not doing it for 10 minutes, Kevin. You pop the inner cover, you take a look, you see how big the cluster is, you see where it is, you put it all back together. There have been instances, Kevin, where in late winter where the bees had consumed all their stores and maybe have an empty frame on the edge of the cluster, and then two frames over is a couple frames of honey.
Yeah.
Moving those honey frames in so they touch the cluster is a good way to keep a colony from starving to death. Okay, but you're not disturbing the cluster. You're just disturbing the frames and moving them next to the cluster so the bees can touch it.
Okay? I've always been leery about taking the roof off and popping that inner cover, because the first thing you hear is all the propolis crack, you know, and they can't in the wintertime come back and put that all back together. And it's not viable for them to do anything when it's cold because it's frozen and hard, and it's not functional. So in that context, I tell people, unless you have an emergency, this hive is not going to make it, and they're going to die whether you open them or not. Stay out of them. Leave them be. Don't be poking around in there. The other thing I think I've seen some people do is take the roof off and take the inner cover off and let all of the heat out. Pop the roof off, pop the inner cover, and just slide it over and peek only what you need and try and keep them covered or do something. Even if you took a drape or a sheet or a blanket or something and put it over it and didn't let all that heat escape, there has to be some balance in that.
But keep in mind, Kevin, inside of a beehive in the winter, the heat is in the cluster area. It's not in the parts of the hive where there is no clustering going on. That tends to be relatively close to the same temperature as it is outside. So yeah. I'm not saying, I mean, this is in the wintertime when they're not rearing much brood. December, January. Now, when you get into February, the cluster starts to loosen and they begin generating heat and brooding up. Different story, okay?
Right.
So just keep that in mind, and I agree with you 100% that if a beekeeper did what they needed to do in September and October, there should be no need to pop those inner covers off in January. I'm telling you right now.
That's the message we're driving for here, right?
That's right.
What I was looking for. And I agree with you. The inside of the hive is ambient temperature in the winter. The cluster might be 55 degrees on the outside, and if they're raising brood, it's 95 in the middle. But make no mistake, the inside of the hive is generally the ambient temperature, maybe a little bit. But I do still believe that whatever heat is coming off is hitting that upper cover. And as you open it, you're letting it all out. And every heat means a waste of resource. I'm wondering what you think about people who are putting quilt boxes and things. I have some of those. I didn't put them on this year with insulation. I'll tell you what I know is I saw pictures on the internet, and I've mentioned this a couple times on the episode, so listeners bear with me for this. A quilt box with insulation, but it has a moisture trap, right? So it's not letting the water drip down
right on
a hive. And when it snows, the box sitting next to it without this, the snow is melting off the roof. But the one with the quilt box, the snow is still sitting there. So it has to be trapping some heat, which has to be benefit to the bees. It's less wasted resource. So I kind of think they're not a bad idea.
Kevin, I wouldn't disagree with you for someone with a few hives in their backyard. But on a large scale basis, it's a tremendous amount of work to put them on and take them off.
Yes.
I don't know if you get as much gain as you would if you made sure they were heavy and they had a large population of young bees going into winter that were not parasitized. Me, as a semi-commercial beekeeper, that's where I think I get the biggest bang for my buck, as opposed to going around and putting a little bit of insulation on top. I'm not judging anybody that does that. Believe me, I agree with you. It probably helps them.
Yeah, a lot of our listeners are 1, 2, 3 hivers. They are hobbyist beekeepers, and we have this phrase around here now called a bee hugger. Somebody called me a bee hugger, Tim.
Oh, really?
Recently. So one of the things I wanted to ask you about, you talked about moisture and ventilating the hive. We want to make sure that we give the right instructions. So the ventilation is on the front, not the back. In other words, you're going to prop up the cover in the front if you're going to put something under it. So if you put it back, you're going to create a chimney effect.
Right, and because I want anything to run off the back if possible, rather than dripping right down on the bees if they're trying to get in and out.
Good. You know, one of the things that I would say is that it's been indicated to me, Tim, that if your hives are old and they have problems and things like that, you can actually tape the seams around them and do it that way, where, you know, just give them a little bit more protection. I don't know, again, a bee hugger concept, but, you know, some of the boxes, the corners have holes in them and things like that. As much airtight as you can make them, the better off they are without wind blowing through them. Hey, Tim, now I do show you muted, and I'm not sure why. Let's see if we can solve that. Do you have a mute button on? There we go. I think you got it now.
When I coughed, it must have automatically done it. Sorry about that.
No, that's okay.
Just rephrase that question again, Kevin.
At minimum, if people have old, worn-out boxes, the corners have holes in them, things like that, there's no harm in running a little painter's tape or duct tape around them to seal them off, help the bees out.
No harm as far as I'm concerned, Kevin. I know there are people that wrap hives with tar paper and such like that. Actually, that would probably make more sense than duct tape as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And that certainly, it's not gonna hurt them.
Good. Anything else here, advice?
You mentioned fondant, and I get that question. Should I put fondant on? And my question to the beekeeper then is, well, how heavy are your hives now? Because fondant is not a part of your regular practice. Putting fondant on is something, or bee candy, that you would do if the bees were not heavy enough. Typically, you do it in late January, February, if that colony, if you hefted it or tipped it forward and it felt light, that's when you want to get some right over top of where the cluster is.
Yeah.
If the cluster is down in the bottom deep super, there's no point in putting fondant on now, Kevin, because they'll have to go through the second deep super to get to it, and they're never going to go that far across no man's land away from the cluster. It's not going to happen.
Right. Some people tell you that you should put it on now so that should that situation occur, they're going to have it at their disposal, and if they don't need it, they won't need it. But I don't know. My preference would be never to feed the bees anyway. I mean, ideally, I don't ever want to have to feed my bees.
I would agree with you 100%, Kevin. The problem is that not every place is beekeeping heaven, like where my buddy Bob Hughes lives, where he almost never has to feed anything. You know, I'm quite envious of people that live in places like that.
Agreed. So anything else? It's wintertime. What should people be doing with their spare cycles?
Well, they ought to be thinking about what they're going to do next year. Are they going to expand? Are they going to split their hives? Are they going to buy new hives? If so, they need to get their equipment assembled, get it ready, make sure all that stuff is ready to go, because once bee season starts, that's not the time to assemble equipment. The time to assemble equipment is from now till the middle of March, I would say. After that, you got to be ready to do bee work, you know?
I think it's a good time, too, to take stock of what happened this year. A lot of times you go out and do an inspection, and you mean to write something down and do whatever, but how was your year in the apiary? What were your observation notes? You can go back year after year and learn a lot if you take the time right now while it's still in your mind. In the springtime, you're not going to remember what happened this fall.
Kevin, that's an excellent idea, and I started doing that about 2 or 3 years ago. Prior to that, I never did much note-taking in my own apiary because everything changed from one visit to the next. But summarizing each year and how well or how bad my business did and what I think my weaknesses were and what I'm going to try to change for next year and writing those things down, I think are very, very important.
Agreed, no doubt. And it's a good time, too, to find some beekeeping books, to do some research, to learn about things you didn't want to do. And that can actually take us into our next topic, Tim, which is queens. Just generally, there's the Miller method, the Doolittle method, there's artificial insemination. I believe in the Advanced Beekeepers course you teach a queen rearing technique. My intent is to read up on these things and learn a little bit more because next year I want to put a queen castle in and a couple nukes and things like that. But maybe you could share some insights on what the beekeeper can do in their yard without any sophisticated stuff.
Well, I'm telling you, Kevin, that's a great question. I think one of the most underused tools that I've seen that have come out in the beekeeping industry is a queen castle. So many people don't have them and should have them. The beautiful thing about a queen castle is it is a way for a beekeeper to raise some of their own queens without doing any grafting, without doing any fancy scientific stuff. A queen castle is a deep hive body that has a bottom on it that allows heat and moisture from a parent colony to get up into that hive body. It's also divided into four compartments that hold two frames each, Kevin. So the concept is this. You put a queen castle on top of a strong colony in your bee yard. And when you find a colony that has queen cells, like it's getting ready to swarm, those are some of the best cells or cells in a colony that's getting ready to swarm because they got too crowded, they got a lot of food coming in, and they're generally one of the strongest colonies in your yard. And just take a frame with eggs and a frame without eggs, but the bees on all the frames, and put them, pair them up in each of those compartments. They each have their own separate entrance. The queen will hatch out of that cell, go out and get mated, and come back. And generally speaking, you'll have a 75% success rate if you do it that way. Number one, you prevent swarming. Number two, you provided yourself with some queens for future needs in the summer without having to buy them. And it's three, it's a lot of fun. It's actually almost as fun as picking up a $50 bill when you're walking down the side of the road and you see it right in front of your
No
face.
Doubt.
I mean, it's just like, it's awesome. It's awesome. It's called a queen castle, Kevin. You don't have to have great eyesight to use it. Everybody can see a queen cell, and it's just a great way to make your own queens. Here's another beautiful thing about it. Once that queen gets established and starts laying in one of those compartments, you can cage her, pick her up, take her away, and use her, and just leave those two frames and the bees and brood in there, and they'll make another one. So once you get this thing started in the early spring, you can perpetuate it through probably most of the season.
Yeah, there's a lot of commentary, too, about local queens, right, and the failure rate on the queens that are coming up with the packages or wherever you're getting them. And if you could keep raising queens that have survived in your yard, that is definitely the way to go.
There's a lot of people that strongly believe in that. The difficulty is the window of time to effectively raise well-mated queens in a place like New Jersey is very, very small compared to some of the southern states. Or the western states.
It's got to be what, May 1st to, say, June 15th?
I would say closer to May 15th to June 15th. And primarily because of having good weather for mating. A lot of times in the middle of May, we're getting tons of rain. Yeah. We may even have cold weather. And if the queen needs to get out and get mated within about 4 or 5 days of her emergence in order to be a healthy, viable queen.
Yeah. You just wish that New Jersey could have a little bit more of a foraging season, you know? It's a bit frustrating at times. And I'm curious, Tim, what you think about, I think we talked about this the last time you were here, the density of beekeepers in New Jersey. And, you know, one of the things I've talked about recently is if I look at a 5-mile radius from my home, I see nothing but corn, soybean, some farm operation. I have a high tension wire that runs across that's going to be a barrier for whatever. And then I have manicured lawns all over the place. There's very few margin. All the county roads, they're cutting it. That seems to be pretty prevalent as I look. I recently flew over New Jersey coming back from a business trip and looked at the way that the state is situated, especially down by where you are. It's all fields, and there's very little margin in bee-style forage. It's a little disappointing and disgusting.
Well, it's a huge problem, and we're getting more and more people keeping bees too, Kevin. So you have more mouths to feed for every square mile of space. You have, instead of having it be wild space, it's all manicured space, whether it be even farm fields. A lot of them are very well kept very clean of weeds and brush around the margins, just like you said. That's why beekeepers educating land use regulators or people that like municipal governments, their neighbors, about planting pollinator buffers is very, very important. The New Jersey Beekeepers Association got that grant to educate people about that. I met a county agent who's trying to get rules passed so that detention basins have to be seeded with blooming plants that bloom in the late seasons of the year.
Right.
Different things like that I think would be very, very beneficial, Kevin, to honeybees, beekeepers, and pollinators in general.
And Tim, tip of the cap to New Jersey Beekeepers Association. I know in the last meeting, I think you were still present, they were talking about working with the power companies and doing the right-of-ways and things like that. So they're being assertive about doing whatever we can to try and bring some of that. And in fact, I know I've mentioned to you we're going to go speak to our local agricultural board, and that's coming up next weekend. And I have a meeting tomorrow night with a couple of our officers in the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association to talk about honing our message. And some of it's going to be this brochure that we worked on, the pesticides, fungicides, and herbicides brochure. Some of this will sneak into that talk to just kind of educate them on what they could do to help us and help themselves.
Kevin, I can't tell you how good that is. The other thing you need to have is some of your members consider joining the Warren County Board of Agriculture and the Hunterdon County Board of Agriculture and attend their meetings so that when these issues are brought up, someone who is a beekeeper can actually have input from our segment of the industry. Very, very important. The other thing is that whole the pollinator grant. The people that worked on that have done a fine job, and the New Jersey Beekeepers Association is going to continue, even after the grant is done, reaching out and educating groups like power companies and right-of-ways and things like that about what they can do to benefit pollinators. The other thing I'll mention to you, Kevin, is we got another grant this year. New Jersey Beekeepers Association and I co-wrote a grant, and we are going to be monitoring pesticide brought back to the hive and fresh pollen by land use area.
Outstanding.
There'll be 5 different land use areas, and we're going to monitor 5 hives in each land use area, sample them once a month for 8 months in next year's growing season. So we can get a feel for our, because everybody wants to say bees are more exposed to a pesticide near a farm or near corn and soy than they are in a suburban backyard or in an urban setting. And I don't know that that's true. And I would certainly like to figure that out. And this is one way we're going to try to do that.
That's outstanding. And this is a type of grants or citizen science that we need. I don't know that you get a chance to listen to our episodes. in our last episode, Bob Kloss and I were talking about a report that just came out that indicated that the neonicotinoids that they're putting on soybeans are actually not effective, any more effective than no treatment whatsoever. And in fact, they're expressing the neonic benefits too early, and the aphids that are eating the soybeans are coming after the neonic wears off, and they're spraying with foliar. And they're saying that if they did no neonics whatsoever on the soybean, they end up with the same result thereabouts. And you can't buy seeds that don't have neonic coatings on them or are packaged with fungicides and whatever. And the curiosity is that they can go look at the corn. I'll have to send you that link. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's really an eye-opening report.
I heard about that report. I also recently read an abstract from a report that was done in Canada where they put beehives on canola that was planted as a seed treated with neonicotinoids, and they found that at I think the level of 2 parts per billion, it was not harmful to the colony or to the baby bees. And they followed these hives that were on that for pollination for quite a long way. It was one of the land grant professors did the research, which was relatively interesting to me. I attended the Pollinator Summit last week on Tuesday down in central Jersey, and one of the scientists that was there that was explaining how some of the research was done. Apparently, some of these neonics are developed so that they stay in the tissue that goes to the foliage, but they don't travel as readily through the tissue that is the reproductive tissue. And in some of the studies, the researchers didn't know that. They ground the whole plant up, which is why they found a lot of the product in there. But yeah, if they would have taken the reproductive plants, the flowers and all that kind of stuff, they would not have found as high a level. I don't know, Kevin. I mean, there's still a lot that needs to be looked into on all that thing, on all those things, which is why I want to do this study. The other thing I'll mention to you is, as part of the National Honeybee Survey, for the second year in a row, I was able to survey fresh pollen on 10 beekeepers. And last year's survey, 2013 survey, the amount of pollen was much lower and much less in concentration than the 2012 survey. 2012, we had 20 different pesticides at varying levels. 2013, we had like 11 different pesticides, and some of them were at trace levels, which is less than 1 part per billion. So I don't know what that means. I don't know why that was. It's just a fact that I'm reporting to you, that's all.
That's an interesting insight about that. You know, I was listening to a recording recently of Dave Mendes. I'm assuming you know who that is, from Florida. And he was going through nutrition of pollen, and he got me to thinking that, of course, all pollen is not created equal, but what do you think about the quality of pollen in the Mid-Atlantic region? Are our bees getting quality pollen? Should, you know, beekeepers look at a hive and say it's light and they feed it sugar solution? Are we getting the right kind of pollens in our hives? Is there something that we should be considering there? Again, bee hugger notion, I know, but just curious if you think that if just one simple pollen patty a year inside of a hive could make the difference between a strong colony going into winter or whatever. Have any experience with that or thoughts on that notion?
Dr. Heather Matilla spoke at our winter meeting back about 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago. She studied under Tom Seeley at Cornell University, and she did trials on feeding supplemental pollen in the fall and found that there was no significant value to the health of the hive when they were fed that. I hesitate to recommend feeding pollen patties in the fall or late summer, because that is the time when small hive beetles are really good at reproducing, and the larvae get up on, or the adults get on the pollen patties, and then the larvae get kind of in there and get a little infestation going. And I don't know how good that would be, Kev. I really don't.
Yeah.
The substitutes are not as good as the natural pollen. We know that for a fact. We know that blueberry pollen is not very good feed for bees. And I think we can make a greater difference if we plant and we continue to educate the public about planting plants that benefit pollinators that would produce pollen and nectar July, August, September, October. Those are the critical times in New Jersey as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, ideally one of the messages we want to give to the farmers too is if they have fields that are sitting fallow, they should be planting something, one, to enrich the soil, and two, potentially to help us out. And the pollinators are going to help them increase their yields. Maybe that's a bit overstated, but I don't think it's that far from the truth.
Kevin, every year I've been spending $500 of my own money on buckwheat seed. I have three farmer friends that I rent bees to, and they sow that on their open ground in August so that there's a nectar flow, even in Vineland, New Jersey, in late August, September. And you know what? They're putting the effort into seeding it. I'm buying the seed. Dave Frank up in Burlington County does the exact same thing. I think he had 20 acres in buckwheat on different farmers' friends' fields. If you have a bee yard on a farm and that guy has some open ground and you talk to him and say, look, I'll buy the buckwheat if you do the sowing. I'll buy the clover seed if you do the sowing. I'm sure that they would work with. But see, oftentimes beekeepers want the farmer to do it all for them with no necessary gain to themselves. Do you see what I mean? This way we're both got skin in the game on it.
Yeah, that's an interesting approach. I don't know if you know that I recorded two or three episodes. They were doing flyovers in Hunterdon County area, seeding cornfields and soybean fields from the sky so that when they harvested them, they could have some late clover and other plants.
Really?
So that the fields were not turned over. I could send you a link to that. It was a program they're trying in the actually, right here where I am, the basin through Hunterdon County and into parts of Warren County, and they were doing aerial seeding to get this fall crop to go and see how much it, one, helps the field and the soil. I think it was a soil conservation effort, and two, they were trying to encourage them not to plow under anything that could potentially be forage for pollinators.
Cool.
So it was a cool program.
I'd also like to see the edges of roadways seeded with beneficial flowering plants and get mowed once a year in, like, this time of year in November.
Yeah. I talked to a local road department person about that, and he just kind of said that they're under mandate, and when they don't do it, they get yelled at by the municipal people because they get complaints of how sloppy it looks, and that's a really difficult battle, I guess.
I think you're right.
You mentioned hive beetles. I wanted to talk about something real quick. I watched this video yesterday that somebody sent me about a hive beetle process which is supposed to be extremely effective. What this person did was they created a barrier around the outside of the hive so that a hive beetle larvae crawling out and falling to the ground would land inside this barrier. They put layers of rock salt inside the container, almost like a garden container, think of it that way, and then they put soil over top of it. They made the soil loose. So the larvae would land on the soil, and then, of course, what's it naturally going to do? It wants to burrow down. It would burrow down and hit the rock salt, but it wouldn't go back up, and it would get stuck there, and it would desiccate and die. And the percentage of hive beetle larvae that died was almost unanimous. And if you could kill the grub, you can really do huge damage to the population. I thought that was a really cool video, and I have to post a copy of that somewhere and share that around. I don't know about you, I don't see huge hive beetle problems here, but I know a lot of people have really big problems with those down south.
Yeah. No, I read that. It was on the Sayer,
yes,
website.
Yeah.
That was a pretty good idea, and it worked really well for that guy and his operation. And it worked the best, as you said, when they had, I think he had rock salt plus other salt, and then the soil on top was important because that caused the beetle larva to burrow into the ground, and they got stuck in the salt layer and got killed, just like you said. And it was 100%.
Yeah, there was a thing that we covered about a line in the pan where they had taken these hive beetles and ground them up, and what they found is that the hive beetles would not cross that if it were mixed in the soil. But I think the problem was is trying to get somebody in the commercial space to commercialize the product. You could take an idea, but you can't get a commercial viability to make money on it. It's going to die on the vine.
That's right. So
this is an alternative method made by a beekeeper, and I thought it was actually pretty ingenious and, you know, great for beekeepers. They love to do this kind of stuff, tinker around. And this guy went through, I'll post a note on our show notes for this, a link to it. You could watch the video where he talked about the permutations he went through until he landed on the example that he came up with the salt underneath the hives.
The other good thing about that, Kevin, is salt will keep the weeds from growing up around your beehives too. So if you've got a little bit of salt in the ground down there, it's going to inhibit plant growth to grow up and block your entrances and things like that.
Yeah, and that's always a good idea.
Yeah.
I was just listening to one of my podcasts earlier, and I recall that the grass was up to my knees in my apiary. So I think that's really a good idea to do whatever you can to try and keep that stuff from growing.
I would agree.
I want to show you something real quick. Let me see if I can get this to cooperate and come up on the screen. It seems to indicate that it's sharing to everybody, but it's not. So I'll describe what it is. This guy took an old lawn tractor that he had, and he mounted a wheelbarrow on the front, and this is what he uses to drive around. What kind of contraption do you have in your yard? Do you have a cart or something that you you use to move your stuff around?
No, I just leave it on my truck, Kevin. My yards, I can drive my flatbed bee truck all into and drive them right up to the bees. And I work off the back of the truck. Like, I'll have lids in one row, supers in another row, et cetera, right on down the line. Got my smoker, fuel my smoker. And if I need to do any scraping, do it right on the truck bed.
Yeah, nice. I wanted to show one other thing I had handy, a couple little trinkets I have. One of the things I do for the wintertime is I build this. This is creamed honey from my batch. I have a couple jars here that I have, and I want to make some more over the winter. And I just, when I was in Las Vegas recently, they had little honey jars about this big, Tim, that they were giving to you to have a tea. And people would pour a little in and just set the thing there. I grabbed every one of them. I came home with a whole box full of them. I take wax and I melt it down and I make lip balm with it and I put them in those little jars.
Ah.
Perfect container. So to me, this is the time of year where you render your wax and do those type of things. You make some hand creams for gifts and you're making creamed honey, which is so good. This is the time of year for me where I'm not out in the yard. I'm doing those type of activities.
Same thing for me, Kev. I'm just getting my honey house washed down. And then I'll be starting with my creamed honey. My honey house is not heated in the winter. So my bottling tank, when I bottle honey, I want it empty because the tank is turned off. I'm just using it for filling jars. And what I do is whatever's left in the tank, I open the valve and let it go into my creamed honey bucket. And then once or twice a week, I run the creaming screw in there. And eventually, over the course of a month, I'll have a full bucket of creamed honey. It's in an unheated barn that probably gets into the 50s, and that's a perfect temperature for creaming honey.
It is, yeah.
I generally get about two and a half buckets a year done, and that's plenty. We sell them in little 8-ounce jars. That's how my wife sells it, and it's just enough for us to supplement her table.
You said you use a creaming something. What was that you used?
It's a stainless steel creaming screw. And what it does is it goes on the end of a drill, and you can, a variable speed drill that will turn slowly. Mm-hmm. And what that does is evenly distribute the seed through the liquid honey.
So what do you use for a starter? Do you just keep using old creamed honey, or did you try it yourself?
I'm going to use last year's creamed honey. Generally, in past years, Kevin, I usually buy at least one jar of creamed honey at the annual NJBA auction. I try to buy one of the winning jars and use that for my starter, because that tends to have the consistency of butter with no grit in it when you put it in your mouth. And that's really what makes the best quality creamed honey, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, good suggestion there. And I know I went and bought some from Trader Joe's once. I didn't like the taste of the honey, but I liked the consistency, and then I mixed it in mine, and fortunately it had my consistency.
Yeah.
And then the stuff that I just showed on the screen was I had a mortar and pestle. Let me tell you, you have to do it once and walk away, and then come back and do it again and walk away, and come back and do it again. You just have to keep going, because it gets real sticky and gummy, and your arm wears out. But no matter what, if you don't do it multiple passes, you're still going to have that little bit of a grittiness to it. And I finally, after grinding and grinding and grinding by hand, got it to the consistency of butter like you suggested.
That makes the best, as far as I'm concerned, Kevin.
Yeah, so I got one more thing to show you here, Tim. Is I've talked about this on the thing. See, this is my new gadget.
A hive tool, Kevin?
It's a hive tool. It's the brand name, and I've mentioned this, is a Jero. And I still want you to try out that Easy Pry hive tool, but I like gadgets, I guess. I like to do product reviews on these, and I'm interested in this one. Tim, this thing is so sharp. Let me tell you, you could shave wood with this thing.
Really?
Super fine razor edge.
I'm a snob for thin hive tools, Kevin. I want that front edge to be as thin as a knife. I really do.
Yeah. It is really, really sharp, and I don't know if let me show it to you again. It's really stiff and thick. You can't bend it whatsoever. It's got an interesting claw on the end that I think it'd be useful. It wasn't very expensive. I think it was like $12 for this. I mean, it's an engineered piece of steel.
Where'd it come from?
I bought it at the fall meeting.
Okay.
NJBE fall meeting. I think I got it from Kelly or Brushy or one of the vendors that was there. So I'm interested. I'm going to do a couple. I don't know. Sometimes I just put it in a kit and I use it for a couple weeks and see whether I like it. I keep going back to the Easy Pry, though. That's my favorite one. One of these days, it's just going to find one in your kit.
Kevin, I'm old school. I'm not shooting you the finger, but if you could see the callus right there,
yeah,
that's because that's where my hive tool rests in my hand all the time. And it's just, it's after 30 years, it's like an extension of your hand, to be honest with you. I have a 14-year-old kid who wants to learn about beekeeping. He's been coming around with me sometimes. And I notice he'll use the hive tool and then set it down. And I'm like, his name's Ben, too, just like my son. I said, Ben, you got to learn how to keep that hive tool in your hand, man. At my hive tool, you're going to lose it, Jackson. You're going to have to buy me a new one.
Yeah.
So, it's funny.
So you put hundreds and hundreds of miles all year long in the warm days driving to and fro. What do you do all winter? What's the state apiarist tasks over winter to get things going? It's time for us to register our hives, right?
It's coming up, Kevin. And I'm not making a lot of announcement about it yet, because my IT department is moving closer to being able to do the online registration that I talked about 4 years ago. And I'm even hesitant to talk about it, because it's been like this millstone around my neck.
God forbid you jinx it, right?
Yeah, and I might just jinx it.
Work, which was supposed to be done in now, and then it got pushed to just before Thanksgiving. Then it got pushed out till mid-January, and it's not my team that did it. My team met the deliverables, but unfortunately the delivery team got delayed on this, so you can... I live the IT slippage thing all the time, but I keep my fingers crossed, because I know that's one of the objectives that you just keep dreaming about.
I'm telling you, man, I am I'm going to be doing a handstand. We're going to have a special beekeeper's corner when we get that thing going, so I can hopefully walk people through how to do it.
That'd be great.
But that, I've been testing, as they make modifications, I've been testing it for them, because I'm the end user of the actual back end, the database. And I've been also trying to go walk through the front end, which will be the beekeeper interface, to make sure that it makes sense and it's not going to be too confusing.
If you want an informed view, I do UI stuff all the time for work, I'd be happy to give you a look. So, you know, one of the things I picked up from your spring talk this year is you've got some lab capabilities and other stuff, which are you putting that to use over the winter?
I try to do that, Kevin. I would look at some of the data we got from testing over the last season. I did 4 studies with beekeepers and Varroa control, and I just looked at general trends during the height of the season. But now I want to digest that information better and then be able to write reports back to each individual beekeeper, as well as a summary report for the beekeeping industry. And that I've got to look at all that data and try to look at it several different ways in order to be able to understand what we learned by committing the time and effort into doing that last year. So that's one of the things that I'll be working on. I need to update my presentations, which I generally do over the course of the winter. Quite frankly, Kevin, I've got like 4 weeks of vacation time that I have to use, or I'll lose it by the end of the year. So from Thanksgiving till Christmas, I won't be doing too much. But now till Thanksgiving, I'm working on these same things. And then in January, I'll be working on the same things again, you know, getting my year-end reports done for all the people that have to have them, beginning to get the winter death loss survey going. And the other thing we're doing is planning out where the participants are going to be for this pollen grant study that we're going to be working on next year. So people ask me, well, this must be your easy time of the year. It's easy because I don't drive as much.
Yeah.
Usually. But it's plenty of brain work still, instead of just brawn work. You know what I mean?
I could so identify with the end of the year stuff, and I too would like to take my vacation stuff. I'm struggling to find time to take a couple days that I probably am just going to give back to the company, because I've got so much work for end of year, and I don't know how your budgets work, but our budgets, everybody tends to want to spend whatever they have towards the end of the year before the year is up. And yeah, I don't know that this is too exciting for our listeners, but I can empathize with the fact that, yeah, there's a lot of work to be done. And you know what? I don't know anybody, Tim, that works like you do, 6-7 days a week, going to bee meetings, up all night, representing. So if you're taking a little time off in December, God bless you, because I know you hump all day, every day, it seems, as far as I could, you know, my viewpoint of things.
Well, I appreciate that, Kevin, and I try to do a good job for the beekeepers in this state.
Yeah. So anything else to close this down? I think we've gone, we've fulfilled our quota here. So just looking to see anything you need to tell the beekeepers in New Jersey until the next time we meet.
Well, if they need to think about if they're going to enter the honey show. It's going to be in the state house again this year. Great opportunity to showcase your products for the legislative people in New Jersey. And really, that's what it's about. Legislators seeing, hey, Tim Schuler's a beekeeper in my district. Tim Schuler's a beekeeper in my town, because mayors are up in the state house and things like that. And we want these people to know that that beekeepers are all throughout the state. They're everywhere. And hopefully some of the legislation will move forward that helps to protect beekeepers against ordinances and things like that. But that's really in the hand of politicians and constituents. And then our winter meeting, one of our speakers is going to be Tony Jadzak, the Maine state apiarist, who actually went to Rutgers and grew up in his beekeeping under the tutelage of Jacob Mathenius, and has been the state apiarist in Maine for probably 25 years, I want to say. He's very opinionated. He does a tremendous amount of testing. Over 70,000 colonies come into his state for wild blueberry pollination. So he'll be a good guy to listen to.
When is that meeting, Tim?
It's going to be on February 4th at the Nottingham Ballroom in Hamilton Township, New Jersey, same place as last year.
Okay, yeah, good. And I don't know if you've heard, we're talking with, should I mention this? I'll hold off, but we have a good guest coming in June also. I'd hate to jeopardize this, so I'll just be quiet, but we have some good meetings for sure, good guests coming through. So, Tim, I know you're under the weather. You took this like a champion. I really appreciate you taking the time to come and talk to us. By any means, if you have other stuff that you want to come back and share with the listeners, love to have you again. And, you know, anything that we could do help support you, we really appreciate what you do for the beekeepers in the state of New Jersey.
Well, Kevin, thanks a lot, and I appreciate, I'm telling you, as I've said at many beekeepers meetings before, that the good things that are happening in the bee industry in New Jersey would not be possible if it wasn't for beekeepers who are very good at other things in their life that sacrifice and donate time to help make these things work. I'll talk about the beekeeping calendar, the pamphlet you just showed a few minutes ago, the grants that have been done to reach out to the public for education, the short courses that are offered, not just through Rutgers, but through individual branches. I know Jersey Cape has had over, I think, 500 people take their beginner beekeeping class that they teach down there. So right across the board, beekeepers working together, donating their time for the betterment of the beekeeping industry. And believe me, Kevin, my job would not be possible without those people that volunteer and help. Anytime that we can get together and talk like this, I'm very happy to do so.
Yeah, and I get a lot of positive feedback, and people appreciate you taking the time also to come and out of your busy schedule and come and talk to us. I'm going to say thanks again, and we'll close this down. I wanted to do one more roundtable topic just to close this off. The barefoot beekeeper, Phil Chandler, has a website, biobees.com. He does a podcast. He released an episode October 9th with Dr. Vanda Shiva, and it's about the fight against genetic modified organisms, GMOs, the piracy and things, and a very insightful talk. It starts out with a great 10-minute segment from Phil himself, and then it goes into this conversation about how Monsanto and Syngenta and DuPont and whatever are managing GMO. And again, I don't get too crazy about all this stuff, but this really is an interesting listen. I encourage everybody to go over and find that episode. I played it for Sharon today, Tim, and she listened to it and understood. It's one of those things that before and after, you have a different take on the world. Maybe it's a little bit of extreme. I don't get too crazy into these, you know, righteous causes and things like that, but I'll send you a link to that too, Tim. I don't think you've heard it. Really interesting discussion and you know, insider baseball about some of these GMOs and the way that some of these companies behave globally. Just an eye-opening thing. I've always been listening, Tim, I don't know about you, I hear all this kind of noise, cacophony about, you know, neonicotinoids and genetically modified and why U.S. is wrong and banning it and all this stuff, and I keep going, I don't get it. I need somebody to kind of explain it to me. Well, this is the one. So I don't know if you've ever had a chance to follow any of that stuff, but I think you would find this interesting.
I appreciate it, Kevin. I'd love to hear it. Incidentally, in one of the American Bee Journal articles, I think it was this year, there was a gentleman who was a research scientist who worked for one of those big companies, and he talked about GMO and how it works, and it was a very understandable article to me. Is it true or not? What do I know? I'm not a scientist guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, the way he explained it, it's like they have the ability to cause a gene to be like quiet, if you will, or closed to some degree, and then allow other genes to be more expressed than less expressed. And he likened it really to like Mendelssohn selecting for certain characteristics in peas, except it takes a lot of time doing it, you know, the breeding method, as opposed to being able to spike genes and shut genes down method. So, you know, what do I know, Kevin? I'm not a scientist. I'm with you. I hear the noise on both sides of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is
my experience. Everybody's got an agenda, though, Kevin.
They do. And you always have to go in with that point of view, is that somebody has an agenda. But I look at it this way. The conversation goes about ownership and intellectual property, the ability to have patents on this stuff. They're patenting life, as she says in the talk.
Right.
You patent life. It was created. It exists.
Right.
How they insert the genes. And while it sounds so incredibly sciencey, it's actually really crude science. I don't want to spoil the message. I need you to go listen to it, everybody, and give it a listen. And I will warn you that you probably want to listen to it once, twice. Third time's even better. I've listened to it three times already, and I just find it really impactful and insightful, and I'll just leave it at that and let everybody make their own opinions of it.
Cool.
So thanks again for listening. We'll wrap it up again. If you want to see the video version of this, you'll be able to watch it on youtube.com/NWNJBA. You can listen to us at www.bkcorner.org. You want to send an email with comments, questions, it's kevin@bkcorner.org. That's where you send an email. Also, appreciate if you can give us a review on iTunes. That helps people understand what the podcast's about, be honest about it. And again, one more time, Tim, thank you so much for coming in and being our guest here, and you're always welcome back.
You're very welcome, Kevin. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Be well, and until next time, bye-bye.